The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jonathan Tracy. I'm the Assistant Director for the National Institute of Military Justice. I want to welcome you all to our program today. I think it's going to be a very exciting program, and it's a very full program, so I'm going to limit my remarks right now. I would like to introduce Dean Grossman. He's going to come up and give some welcoming remarks. But first, I just want to thank the Dean for his very hospitable and grateful manner in which he treats the National Institute of Military Justice. We have been affiliated with the law school for a couple of years now, and it is a great place to be, and we are very appreciative of the support that we get from the law school. Dean.
On behalf of American University Washington College of Law, good morning. I am the Dean of the Washington College of Law, and it's my pleasure to welcome all of you to our law school for this important conference on the jurisprudence of the military commissions. The conference topic is a vital one, and even more so given this moment in history and the new U.S. Administration. In his first 2 days in office, President Obama has sought the suspension of legal proceedings involving detainees at Guantanamo Bay and signed an executive order requiring the closure of those facilities within a year. These swift actions signal a strong message and have tremendous implications as we move forward, including for the future of military commissions. In this context, today's conference could hardly be more timely or relevant. This conference is being presented by the National Institute of Military Justice as a part of the law school's 2009 founder celebration, through which each spring our law school offers more than 60 conferences and programs on key issues of our time. These programs are open to the public and webcast and podcast, further expanding their accessibility and outreach. Our law school considers it as an essential part of our educational mission to provide a forum where the fundamental issues of our time are examined in an open and diverse environment. Today's conference, continuing with that tradition, provides a unique perspective on military commissions as it focuses on the developments of the law for military commissions over the last few years and the law surrounding the military commissions. We should not ignore that the conference is also of great importance to scholars of national security law, international humanitarian law, and to the federal prosecution of cases involving terrorism. This event panel topics are also unique, covering issues of jurisdiction, discovery, and evidentiary matters, and they include broad expert representation by participants representing the military, academia, and the non-governmental organization. I look forward to engaging in insightful exchanges from our distinguished panelists about the litigation they were involved in, and I thank all of them for their contributions today. As I mentioned before, this conference is part of our founders' program. In 1896, two pioneer women created this law school, Ellen Spencer Massey and Emma Julie, in a moment when women were not accepted into a legal profession and into the study of the law. And this pioneer spirit has since then inspired our own vision of this institution. And as part of that vision, we address constantly key issues of our time, enhancing the quality of public debate. There is hardly an issue that doesn't have a legal connotation, and also in these matters, in keeping with our tradition, we see the relevance of the law and the rule of law, and then we welcome all of you to participate in those exchanges. I also would like to thank the National Institutes of Military Justice, including its president, Eugene Fidel, who is here, and he has been a very important leader in this matter, and we would not be here had it not been by his insight, his organization capability, and his knowledge on the topic. So Jean, we are pleased to have you in our community, as well as his director, Michelle Lindo McClure, and assistant director, Jonathan Tracy, all of three of whom are participating on conference panel. The Institute is the premier institution working to promote the fair administration of justice in the military system and to educate the public, press, and Congress about military justice. The Institute has been in residence in our school since December 2005, and our institution's unique relationship has led to the creation of valuable programs, such as the one being offered today, that greatly enhance our collective understanding of this crucial area of the law. Just last week, to give a very recent example, this Institute provided exception opportunities to our students, for example, Mike McNerney, sending him to observe the hearings at Guantanamo Bay. This unique exposure to a military justice system is, to say the least, quite rare, and even more so for students. They also engage and enrich our academic community and enhance our understanding ability to make meaningful contributions on important matters. But again, the importance of the Institute go well beyond what it means concretely to a law school, but it provides guidance to an important area for the community, the nation, and the world. Well, before we begin, I would like to thank retired Major General John Altenburg, Jr., our keynote speaker for this conference. Major General Altenburg took office as the appointing authority for military commissions in 2003, where he was responsible for overseeing many aspects of the military commission, including approving charges and plea agreements and appointing military commission members. Let me mention to you that we are honored to have him with us today, and we greatly anticipate his keynote address. I would also like to thank Colonel Lawrence Morris, Chief Prosecutor of the Commission, Colonel Peter Masciola, Chief of the Defense Office, as well as the Law School's Office of Special Events and Continuing Legal Education for their exceptional organization of this conference. Now, without further delay, join me in welcoming Eugene Fidel, the President of the Institute.
Thanks very much, Claudio. I'd like to welcome everybody to assemble a group of experts to prepare an annotated guide to the procedures for trials by military commissions. This was close to being an instant book, and it was the first sustained effort to analyze the emerging process from a scholarly and practitioner's perspective, and basically without spin. We have the support of LexisNexis, and in a very short time, our little paperback was available. It was not a moneymaker for our publisher or for NIMJ, but I do think that LexisNexis deserves great credit for humoring us by publishing it. They did perform an important public service, and it was encouraging to us and those, I think, who were taking an early and active interest in the subject. No sooner had the guide come out than it became apparent that there was going to be a lot more to do in support of NIMJ's twin objectives of advancing the fair administration of justice and fostering improved public understanding. Indeed, it turns out that our work had just begun. The Pentagon started issuing military commission instructions on numerous aspects of the process as it existed under President Bush's military order. We responded by preparing two volumes of military commission instructions source books. Again, the directors and advisors of NIMJ sprang into action by generating detailed comments on each of these instructions, and the resulting volumes included hard copy of many other key documents as well. It was in this connection that NIMJ found itself compelled to submit a FOIA request for correspondence to and from the Defense Department concerning the military commission rules. I was surprised at the department's refusal to make public correspondence with the small coterie of former officials to whom Secretary Rumsfeld had turned. We had to bring our first and to date only lawsuit, and in the end, we lost 2-1 in the D.C. Circuit. The Supreme Court denied our petition for certiorari. I would like to take this opportunity to express appreciation to our indefatigable pro bono attorneys, Mark Lynch of Covington and Burling, and Andrew Pincus and Raj Day of Mayor Brown. They were extremely generous with their time and effort, and their work was in keeping with the highest traditions of the bar. Parenthetically, I should mention that despite the outcome of the litigation, NIMJ anticipates renewing our request for the withheld documents in light of President Obama's announcement just the other day about revised government policy with respect to the administration of FOIA. NIMJ became increasingly involved with the military commissions and the controversy that surrounded them from the beginning. Our website, which is nimj.org, soon included a section devoted to the commissions. We began to file amicus briefs related to the commissions, and we filed one of the very first such briefs with the military commission itself. Our directors, advisors, and staff, and here I should make special mention of our first executive director, Commander Kathleen Degnan, were fixtures in media coverage of the commissions. We also participated in the legislative process that unfortunately led to enactment of the Military Commissions Act of 2006. In retrospect, Congress would have done well to heed our advice rather than embark on the path it took under pressure from the White House as the 2006 elections loomed. Our core recommendation was that no case should be tried by a military commission unless the Attorney General certified that it was literally impossible to prosecute in federal district court. If only. As the commission's ground on, NIMJ sought and eventually obtained observer status. Thus far, we've had four observers on the ground at Guantanamo from our staff and advisory board, including Professor Diane Marie Amon of the University of California, Davis School of Law, Director Michelle Lindo, Michelle Lindo McClure, Assistant Director John Tracy, whom you've met, advisory board member Arnon Siegel, and most recently Dean's Fellow Mike McNerney. Thanks to each of them. Finally, let me mention our works in progress. We have in preparation not only additional source book volumes, but also a hard copy volume of military commission reports that will bring together in one handy place all of the known rulings of the military commissions. This should be available in a few weeks, and I'm very pleased to report that it will include a foreword by Judge Patricia M. Wald, formerly of the D.C. Circuit and the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. Thank you, Judge Wald, and thanks as well to John Tracy and Irina Vayner of NIMJ's staff, as well as Mike McNerney, for their excellent work in bringing this project to fruition. As the ultimate fate of the military commissions is debated and its history examined by scholars, this will be an important and useful resource. So with that by way of preface, let's turn to the business of the day, and I'd like to invite Michelle McClure to convene the first panel. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Welcome everybody here. I see some faces that I've known for years and then a lot of new faces, so combining my past life and my present life. Our guest today on our first panel, we are delighted to have Dr. Louis Fisher, who's a specialist in constitutional law. He's currently with the Law Library of the Library of Congress, and this is after a long career for the Congressional Research Service. He's a prolific writer, having published more books than I can talk about right here, but most notably, he received the Neustadt Award for Military Tribunals and Presidential Power. So obviously, he has quite a bit of knowledge on the subject. He's also testified before Congress on such things as war powers, state secrets, NSA surveillance, as well as budgetary issues, and his expertise has been sought by other nations as well. He's helped in forming the constitutions of a number of countries. And his specialties include, and as you would imagine, constitutional law, war powers, budget policy, executive legislative relations, and judicial and congressional relations. So we welcome Dr. Fisher. Now we also have today two uniformed members of the service. We have the Chief Defense Counsel from the Office of Military Commissions, Colonel Pete Masciola. He is an Air National Guard assistant to the Command Staff Judge Advocate for Headquarters, United States Air Forces in Europe. He's currently on an extended active duty tour with the Office of Military Commissions as the Chief Defense Counsel. There he supervises a staff of 130 military attorneys, paralegals, investigators, as well as intel analysts, and they represent the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Before he assumed these duties, he was the Air National Guard Judge Advocate, Assistant to the Commander for First Air Force. And for those of you all who aren't familiar with the way the Air Force is set up, First Air Force is basically in charge of the homeland defense of the nation. It's based at Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida. It's when you hear about things being scrambled, if there's some sort of alert, most likely First Air Force is involved. So certainly has a wealth of experience in that position. And previously served on active duty in a civilian capacity, Colonel Masciola has a law practice in D.C., specializing in medical malpractice. He is also a past chair of the Federal Tort Claims and Military Advocacy Section of the American Association for Justice. So we welcome Colonel Masciola. In addition, we wanted to have balance, and we're delighted that we're able to have today here with us Colonel Larry Morris, who is the Chief Prosecutor for the Office of Military Commissions. And he previously served as, I believe it was the TCAP Chief for the Trial Counsel Assistance Program in the Army, and has been the Chief for the Office of Prosecutions for about a year, year and a half now. And in his capacity, much like Colonel Masciola, supervises all the prosecutors, the uniformed prosecutors, who are prosecuting the cases at Guantanamo Bay. So we're delighted to have him here as well today. And with that, we'll let the panel each make a few comments and then open up for questions. And we're going to start off today with some historical notes from Dr. Fisher.
Good morning. What I want to do is talk about what the Justice Department said in court about the source of presidential power to create military tribunals. And then second, look at the case that's always cited, the Nazi Saboteur case of 1942, ex parte Kieran. The Bush Justice Department in court in legal briefs claimed that military tribunals, quote, have tried enemy combatants since the earliest days of the Republic under such procedures as the President has deemed fit. I don't know how many historians there are in the Justice Department. If there aren't, they should have a few, to take a look back in the early days of the Republic and see how it was done. Because far from the President doing whatever he wanted to with military tribunals as he deemed fit, they were done by the Continental Congress, as Congress deemed fit by law, by articles of war. So military tribunals operated under partly June 30, 1775, the Continental Congress adopted rules and regulations for the military in a series of 69 articles of war. General George Washington at that time understood that the source of authority was the Continental Congress, and he understood that any change, any modification in the military code, quote, can only be defined and fixed by Congress. The Justice Department in its legal briefs referred to the 1780 case of John Andre, the British spy. Justice Department said, quote, it was well recognized when the Constitution was written and ratified that one of the powers inherent in military command was the authority to institute tribunals for punishing enemy violations of the laws of war. Now, when General Washington convened a board of officers to try Major John Andre, it was done under the Articles of War adopted by the Continental Congress. According to the Justice Department, quote, there was no provision in the American Articles of War providing for the jurisdiction and a court-martial to try an enemy for the offense of spying. In fact, the Continental Congress in 1776 adopted a resolution expressly providing that enemy spies, quote, shall suffer death by sentence of a court-martial. The previous year, the Continental Congress made it punishable by court-martial for members of the Continental Congress to hold correspondence with or give intelligence to the enemy. As a final matter, those of you who have been in school, you cannot find presidential power in 1780. There wasn't any president then. There wasn't any executive branch there. There's one branch of government. That was the Continental Congress, one branch. There's no separate judiciary, no separate executive. The Justice Department's briefs on military tribunals will cite different examples of military tribunals. General Andrew Jackson, 1818, in the Seminole War, the British subjects then. The case, the Andersonville Civil War case of Captain Henry Wirtz, the Lincoln conspirators, many others. As I look at military tribunals from time of the American Revolution up to the present time, there are very few that are at all attractive or that you would want to duplicate again. The one that I find most justifiable was in the Mexican War, where General Winfield Scott created tribunals, not just to try Mexicans, but most particularly to try American soldiers. They were very raw, untrained talent, and he was afraid that if they got out of bounds, they would start an insurgency. General Scott never claimed any inherent power to create them. He wanted Congress to create them before he went into Mexico, and he always recognized that Congress at any time could change whatever he did. So let me turn to the Nazi saboteur case. Last December 21, in an interview with Chris Wallace, Vice President Dick Cheney said about military commissions, we followed precedent. We did exactly what was done by FDR in World War II, subsequently upheld by the Supreme Court in a decision the court made. In 2004, in the Hamdi case, the plurality did say that the Nazi saboteur case was the, quote, most apt, the most apposite precedent, But in that same case, in a dissent, Scalia and Stevens, interesting combination, Scalia and Stevens referred to the Nazi saboteur case as, quote, not this court's most final, not this court's finest hour. So what could Scalia and Stevens have in mind for using language that they didn't specify anything? Let's take a look at what happened. I think a lot of you know the elementary sayings that eight saboteurs arrived in two submarines. Some got off in Long Island, some got off near Jacksonville, Florida. And they came for the purpose of doing damage to America's industrial might. They brought with them explosives, fuses, and different things, and they were quickly apprehended. Let's look at the process and ask yourselves if you would like this process used against an American abroad. President Roosevelt created the tribunals with a proclamation and military order. He named the seven generals to serve on the tribunal, all subordinate to him. He named the co-prosecutors, Attorney General Francis Biddle, and the Judge Advocate General of the Army, Myron Kramer, both subordinate to him. He named the Defense Council, colonels, all subordinate to him. After the tribunal would finish its work, the trial record would go, you probably can't guess, would go to President Roosevelt for final disposition. So a total circle, no independence anywhere. Then you have to ask, why was a tribunal created? Because initially, the government was going to try the 8 saboteurs in civil court. And the person who turned himself in and helped get the other 7 was concerned. Of course, he had family back in Germany. But the government said, don't worry, we'll just go in. You just quickly say guilty, and then we'll put in process a presidential pardon for you. But this individual, George Dash, saw that it was getting into papers, saw his photo in the paper, and he decided if he goes into civil court, he will tell exactly what happened. He went to the FBI, he turned himself in, he helped get the other 7. And that the government could not accept. The government had told the country and enemies that they have this amazing capacity to pick up saboteurs wherever they come in. So they could not have George Dash going into open court and explaining it. Second reason was the penalty. People in the Justice Department and Judge Advocate General could not find a basis for putting them in prison for more than 2 years or maybe 3 years. And President Roosevelt wanted a death sentence. So that was the second reason not to go to civil court. And I think a third benefit of the tribunal, you could make up rules, because when the tribunal began, there were no rules in place. And the only way you got rules is someone would raise an objection and the tribunal members would disappear and come back with a ruling. So that's the way it was done. In setting it up as they did, Secretary of War Henry Stimson was offended that Attorney General Biddle would take out several weeks in the middle of World War II to conduct the prosecution. Anybody in the Justice Department could have done it, but Stimson saw that Biddle was bitten, as he says, by the bug of publicity. And the Judge Advocate General should not have been co-prosecutor. He should have been an independent spot to make sure that fairness was followed. How about some differences? Differences between the Nazi saboteur case and Guantanamo detainees. First of all, there was evidence. The boxes were taken out of the sand. You had all the evidence you needed as to what they intended to do. There was no coercion used, as was the case in Guantanamo elsewhere, to get evidence. The Nazi saboteurs were charged, 4 charges, 2 under the Articles of War, 1 under the Law of War, 1 conspiracy. They had counsel, very, very good counsel. They were tried. They were sentenced. None of that applied to Guantanamo in the early years. And I'll just end with a little bit of flavor as to how this got to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had announced that it would hear this case on July 29, 1942. There had been nothing in lower court, no activity at all. Somehow it was going to hear this right from the bat. Well, the previous night, the defense counsel finally got to district court. They were turned down at 8 p.m. In terms of the habeas petition. They had to start oral argument the next day at noon. There had been no action by the appellate court, D.C. Circuit. The briefs are dated the same day that oral argument began, which means the justices are not prepared. This is not an area that they covered at all. So the amazing thing is that oral argument went on for 2 days over 9 hours. I think that was as much for the benefit of justices as any, just trying to get their arms around this kind of a case as to the jurisdiction of the military commission. So after 2 days of oral argument, on the very next day, the Supreme Court is ready to decide. And they're waiting for the papers to come from D.C. Circuit, and they come over around 11:59 in the morning. The Supreme Court grants cert, and 1 minute later, they hand down a decision. It's not really a decision. It's a per curiam, just saying that the military commission has jurisdiction. And the per curiam says the full decision with legal reasoning will come down as soon as we can. It took them 3 months. When they upheld the jurisdiction of the military tribunal, the tribunal finished, recommended death sentence for 8. 2 were put in prison, and 6 within a matter of days were electrocuted. So now the Supreme Court is having to write the full opinion with the knowledge that 6 are dead. And it's up to Justice Chief Justice Stone from his home trying to put this together. And I just want to read, while he's trying to draft this, Stone wrote to Justice Felix Frankfurter that he found it, quote, very difficult to support the government's construction of the Articles of War. And he added that it, quote, seems almost brutal to announce this ground of decision for the first time after six of the petitioners have been executed, and it is too late for them to raise the question if, in fact, the articles as they construe them have been violated. Only years later, Stone understood, with the transcript of the commission be released, other documents, related documents released, the two surviving saboteurs, the one given prison sentences, could then raise legal questions, which Stone said would not place the present court in a very happy light. If they prevailed in court, Stone said, quote, it would leave the present court in the unenviable position of having stood by and allowed six to go to their death without making it plain to all concerned, including the president, that it had left undecided a question on which counsel strongly relied to secure petitioners' liberty. After the decision came down, Justice Frankfurter asked a former student and now an expert on military law, Frederick Bernays Wiener, to analyze what the court did in the final opinion. And Wiener wrote three very long letters to Frankfurter. He said the deficiencies of the decision flowed, quote, in a large measure from the administration's disregard for, quote, almost every precedent in the books when it established the military tribunal. Wiener said that court-martial procedures had, quote, almost uniformly been applied to military commissions, and that it was too plain for argument that the president could not waive or override the required review by the Judge Advocate General's office. I'm going to stop with that. I just want to remind you that both the court and the Roosevelt administration repudiated what it did in 1942. Namely, in November 1944, another submarine comes from Germany carrying two people. They get off in Maine. They get down to Boston, get down to New York City. They get picked up. And the administration was going to do it exactly as it had done in 1942. This time, Stimson intervened, lobbied, Roosevelt lobbied everybody. He said, don't do this. Don't have the president involved. Give it to professionals, the military. And it was taken out of Roosevelt's hands and given to the military up in Governor's Island. Then I say the court repudiated because in 1953, and I'll end with this, the case in the middle of the summer, just like the Nazi saboteur case, came the Rosenberg case, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. And the justices were sitting and saying, is it possible in the middle of the summer to take a case and just do a per curiam and come down later with a full opinion? And several justices, including Jackson Frankfurter, says, no, you know, we did that once. We're not going to do that again. So that's the history of the Kieran case. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Fisher. Now we'll hear from Colonel Morris.
Good morning, everybody. I'm here in large part out of respect for my longtime friendly adversary, Mr. Fidel, and I appreciate the chance to be with you, be on the panel with Mr. Fisher, whom I've never met, but whose work I've consumed over the years working in this process. So there are two people whose stuff I'd suggest you read. One is his articles and books, and another is a woman named, who I've not met either, Jennifer Elsey, E-L-S-E-A, whose stuff from the Library of Congress is excellent, dispassionate, you know, wonderfully researched background on this whole process. I'm going to switch a little bit of what I had planned to talk about. Let's do this instead. Let's pretend you're on, oh, say, the third day of a new president's administration, and you're called in to a planning meeting. I mean, what if you've read the you know, every article, every criticism of which we've benefited from plenty over time of the commission's process talks about, criticizes what's been going on. And what's the last paragraph say? But we should do what? What's the solution, the forward-looking solution, everybody's throwaway line in a criticism of the commission's process? Anybody? Come up with national security courts, right? I mean, Article III courts are not quite the right model, but, you know, these jackbooted military commissions are not the right answer. So we just need a national security court. So let's move from the abstract to the planning meeting that you're in this morning, when the administration has decided, has acknowledged that maybe Article III won't quite work, but we can't stick with the commission's process. So what are the assumptions that we start with as we walk through setting up a new court system? What would be your first, your foundational assumption? I wish we had a blackboard here, but what would be the first thing stated most broadly? You want a system to bring justice, right? Now, what would be next as you start to hang some flesh on national security courts? What kind of process would it be? How do we characterize a just process, criminal process? What is it at its core? What's the court always say when you test, the results of a trial process? What do you finally get down to? Is it a truth-seeking process, right? Does this contribute to finding truth? So let's say that would be the next of our criteria. Is it a truth-seeking process? What would be the kind of things you would look at to make it truth-seeking? What protections, rights, procedures do you load in to make it a truth-seeking process? Burden of proof on the government? Proof beyond a reasonable doubt, maybe? Equal access to evidence? What else? Right to present a defense? Right to not present a defense and not have it held against you? Man. Right to a defense counsel?
Exclusion of coerced evidence.
Exclusion of coerced evidence. What does that provide to you? The reason you exclude coerced evidence is because it might not be trustworthy because of the way it, the circumstance under which it's taken, right? So you want reliable evidence, and you want a way to test the reliability of that. So use a term like coerced, and then how do you operationalize that?
Use Supreme Court precedent.
So as you're writing a rule, you're drafting a rule of procedure, what would the rule say? Something like evidence.
As protected by the due process clause.
I mean, put coercion into a sentence then. Say something like evidence produced as a result of coercion shall be inadmissible in this court. Something like that, right? Now, is that because it somehow offends our sense of justice, you know, our sense of values alone or also, or just that you can't trust it because it's a result of coercion? And to what extent does that rule exist now if you walk down into federal court today or walk into a Maryland court this morning? Is evidence as a result of coercion admissible in those cases, in those courts?
No.
Is that because it's codified or because that's how what you would develop in a motion practice? We won't find in those, you won't find in the Maryland or the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure a line that says evidence as a result of coercion is it admissible, right? But you would be able to litigate the admissibility of evidence, including claiming that taking all of the circumstances together, that evidence is untrustworthy because it overbore his will against self-incrimination and all those factors, right? So we would put that factor in. You want to ensure that only trustworthy evidence is admitted into evidence. You probably want a unanimous verdict. Probably in a capital case, you'd want to have aggravating factors. Let's go to the next area. If you're a prosecutor, you want to be able to rely on physical evidence and testimonial evidence, right? You want to be able to present evidence regardless of while evaluating the circumstances under which it's gathered, right? Now, why are we in a national security court then? Because there's some concern about that Article III might not be sufficient forum to protect any national security concerns. So what are those concerns? What gets most of the ardent critics of the military commission's process to say, we don't like the commission's process, but Article 3 might not work either, therefore we need flexibility? In what areas might you need flexibility, and how do you draft rules to introduce that flexibility? Where do you need it? Please.
Well, don't we have that in CIPA?
In what regard?
With regards to protecting classified information.
Sources, methods of obtaining information, right? So there you're concerned with stuff or with statements? Potentially with both, right? I mean, the CIPA rules, as I think many of you know, are, and there's an equivalent in the court-martial process and a close equivalent, but not identical, in the commission's process, that provides under some circumstances for out-of-court adjudication of basically how and where we got stuff, right? So it can mean operating in some other country where it might not be in our national interest or in that country's national interest to be known that we're working there, or the people who we worked with to get information, or the way we happened to pick it up by, national technical means, that the evidence itself is highly probative, right? And if you hear somebody having a conversation with another person, that's about as probative as it gets, but the fact that we might have heard it or the way we might have heard it might not be something that would advance our national security to have them know, right? Because then you might not hear it anymore. You might switch to another wavelength or another way of doing things. Or the place that we got it might be a place where we operated that maybe, all things considered, all parties would rather not have it known that we were there, or all the people who are cooperating getting the stuff, right? So you want some way to be able still to use evidence that's valuable, but not to have to expose all of that. Question comes up, of course, is, how do you manage that in a way that doesn't open a gaping hole for, exploitive, lazy, misguided prosecutors or government to go through, right? Which takes you back to your CIPA model. What happens under CIPA? You take that to an independent judge. You bring declarations from the owners or managers of that information. The independent judge decides whether you can admit a substitute of evidence or whether the government hasn't met that burden, sends them back, and there's a back and forth process by which that is managed, and then a determination is made whether it can be used. You end up also in a situation where a lot of evidence is gathered in ways that can't begin to comport with the Fourth Amendment, right? You're operating on battlefields, a distinction from Mr. Fisher's situation where he said we had all the evidence in the Kieran case, which we did because they land on the beach and bury their stuff in their uniforms. So had the hottest of crime scenes, not in a cave in Waziristan. But sometimes we are, and sometimes we are in circumstances, and certainly have been as we go from the abstract to what we're really doing. You have soldiers operating under intense environments far away, grabbing stuff, not because they're forward deployed cops, but because they're soldiers doing their job to win wars and defend the country. So then the question comes up, the fact that somebody gets stuff because he's in there fighting a war, and that there's no semblance of a chain of custody. I mean, any of us on our third day of law school could pierce holes in the chain of custody that comes from a guy who jams stuff in a bag and heaves it onto a helicopter. There isn't the traditional chain of custody there. But if on the other end you pull it out and it has forged passports with terrorists' thumbprints on it, do you not let that into court because you don't have the ordinary chain of custody certificate, or do you let it in with all of the expectation that the defense can test it and that you then leave the burden to the government as it should be? And in doing that, do you provide the same rules to the defense to bring in evidence that similarly might not have the same conventional chains that we have, that might also have gathered a statement from somebody 2 or 3 or 5 years ago who you can't account for or can't find? Do you set a screen at the threshold so much that you don't let that evidence in, or do you trust juries to figure it out? So my suggestion to you is, we already have a national security court, and that's what the commissions are. When you get beyond the kind of the easy, no due process kind of rhetoric, what the nation has in front of it and what it's used over all the years that Mr. Fisher has studied it and people have looked at it is varying iterations of increasingly stringent due process that are national security courts that have to balance all those factors. So when you get from we should have a national security court and get into the planning meeting that says, okay, cook it up. Tell me where you're going to deviate from Article 3. You find yourself always coming back to the same areas. And those are concerns where you have to balance the practicality of fighting a war, the practicality of our being partners with plenty of other people and organizations in lots of places around the world. And you balance the fact that those statements could not be admitted in Article 3 court, not because they're coerced. I mean, a coerced situation, you end up, you argue that in any, statement litigation that we do in, courts martial or civilian courts anyway. I mean, other than your technical Miranda violations and that sort of thing, most of your statement cases go to does the level of pressure, right, the level of pressure that the police put on in these circumstances so overbear the will against self-incrimination that it's a violation and makes it unreliable evidence. So you have kind of the same issue here. Taking into account all the circumstances, do you trust the evidence or not? And then you fight it out, and then an independent jury decides. In the evidence collection area, same thing. If you're going to have any flexibility, then the question is it what it purports to be? Look at all the circumstances under which it's taken. Let a jury decide whether, to what extent they want to trust it or not. From the national security standpoint, when you're putting that information in, then must you put it in a way that itself could call into question our ability to continue to fight those wars, right? Does it make less effective tactics that we would use in the future? I'd also ask you as you think this stuff through, I mean, this is a great time to be at this because the administration's going to scrub and relook everything that's gone on for a lot of years. Look at it in light of what you understand this to be, what we understand our national values to be, and what the interest is in bringing to justice people who you're not obliged to bring to justice at all. There's no obligation to try anybody. They are lawfully held, irrespective of any obligation to try them. And when you take all those factors together, that calls for a system that has evidentiary flexibility, that recognizes the circumstances under which a war like this is being fought, but is rightfully and properly fastened to what our core national values are. And those aren't ones that we end up, writing essays about and getting abstract about. They are reflected in the rules you write. They're reflected in why these rules, why these commissions are so greatly different from the Kieran Commission that Mr. Fisher talked about. Now, he mentioned that the Kieran Commission was based on evidence. There was no coercion. They had counsel, and they were actually tried. Look at the evidence there, right? The evidence was sitting right in front of us. We didn't have to deal with partner nations, wiretaps, different locations. There was no semblance of discovery in that case. There was no right to independent evidence. There was no right to a civilian counsel. It was done completely in secret. It wasn't in the open. It wasn't open to the press and public. They were tried in secret. Two-thirds vote in a capital case. No unanimous votes, no aggravating factors, no right to voir dire the judge, no right to voir dire the panel. So it has rightly changed significantly in those 60 years while codifying the major changes that have been in the law. So just ask you all to put some of those things in mind while we, participate in, our nation's healthy relook at what got us to this point. And the successful due process-based prosecutions and developments we've had over the last several years in the commission's process. Thanks.
Thank you, Colonel Morris. And now we'll hear from Colonel Masciola.
Good morning, everyone. About a month before 9/11, Muhammad al-Qahtani attempted to get into the United States and was turned away. He was trying to get into Miami. He is alleged to have tried to get into Miami to be the 20th hijacker. In 2002, he was picked up in Afghanistan and flown back to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. During the course of 48 consecutive days out of 54 days, he was tortured by the United States, according to Judge Crawford, the current convening authority in the military commission's process. What happened to him met the legal definition of torture. For those 48 days, he was interrogated for 18 to 20 hours a day. 18 to 20 hours a day. He was forced to stand naked in front of female agents. Dog collars were put around his neck. He was forced to do dog tricks. He was threatened with his life. His mother and sister were called whores. There were threats about his family. On two occasions, he almost died, bradycardia. His heart rate went down so low that he was near death. Agents of the United States use these enhanced interrogation techniques, and Judge Crawford, in her review as to whether or not Colonel Morris's office was going to be allowed to charge Muhammad al-Qahtani a few weeks ago, decided that his case was not going to go forward because cumulatively, the cumulative use of these enhanced interrogation techniques amounted to what she told Mr. Woodward from the Washington Post in an interview last Wednesday, that they amounted to torture, and that she morally and in good conscience could not go forward in this case. Now, this is a case that had been charged before and had been withdrawn before and that was planning to be recharged again. Judge Crawford also made some interesting statements in her interview. And some of those statements, I think, really gets to the heart of the matter of the military commission's process and really what the new President Obama administration is facing. I just got back from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba last night, and the 9/11 hearings went on a Monday and Tuesday, a Monday on Martin Luther King Day, celebration of freedom and justice, and Tuesday on the inauguration day. As you all know, they have now been continued at the order of President Obama and the direction of Secretary Gates to Colonel Morris and his prosecutors to file 120-day continuances in the cases. Both were granted by the judge, and we expect all cases will be continued now pursuant to the executive orders that were just released yesterday. Go back to Judge Crawford's interview. She said, quote, "I assume torture in the other 9/11 cases." And there's five cases now that are consolidated for trial down in Guantanamo Bay. Well, if you assume, Judge Crawford, torture, why don't you withdraw these cases and find out if there was torture? I sent a letter drafted by several members of my staff and myself Friday to her, asking her to do just that, not to continue these cases in the military commission's process, but to withdraw all charges until we can determine, not only in the five 9/11 cases, whether there has been the legal definition of torture done by agents of the United States government at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan and in Iraq. What is the extent of the enhanced interrogation techniques and the torture for each case? And how should that affect the charging and how these cases go forward? Can they go forward like Muhammad al-Qahtani's cases? And if so, how should they go forward? There's currently 22 cases charged. Two cases are over with and are on appeal. I've got defense counsel here, some of whom I'm going to speak with you later. Major Jackson, who represents Mr. Hassawi. Major Fracht, who represents Mr. Jawad. Commander Miser, are you here?
Yes, sir.
Commander Miser represents Mr. Ali. Mr. Hassawi and Mr. Ali are two of those five 9/11 defendants. Would you guys just stand up, all the members of the defense team, stand up, please? Just so you see who they are, and you might be able to catch them on breaks. I just want to just take a moment and thank them for their service, because I just got on board on the 2nd of September, and I can tell you the challenges of representing alleged Al-Qaeda and Taliban terrorists and alleged enemies of the United States is, I think, unique in military jurisprudence. Some of the issues that has been out in open court, even this week, for example, where Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Sheba made comments to the effect of, let's just get this farce over with, let us plead guilty, we want to be martyrs, put us to death, or words to that effect. Some of these people hate us and truly would like to put a bullet in our head as opposed to sit in a courtroom with us or do anything else. They especially hate uniformed military members, and despite all those obstacles, our defense counsel have been able to overcome them and have some kind of attorney-client relationships. Three of the five 9/11 accused actually represent themselves. Two are pending sanity board issues, and their detailed defense counsel represent themselves. Commander Lachelier in the Ramzi bin al-Sheba case, and Major Jackson in the al-Hasawi case, are the two that are detailed counsel and of the five defendants who represent himself. These two detailed counsel still speak for their clients in court. So what happened in court as we proceeded? Judge Crawford never answered the mail, if you will, and never made any kind of decision about withdrawing the cases. And it's not only those five cases. It's clear to us that public source information has disclosed credible evidence of torture in most of those other 22 cases. So until you fully investigate and see what the United States, how can you move forward in any judicial system? And I think you can see from the executive orders that that's what President-elect Obama is going to have to look at. That is the first issue. Did we torture, and if so, how much? And what should that mean to whatever system of justice is going to go forward in this process? Our equities are going to be, since we have detailed defense counsel, there's usually typically at least two military counsel. About half the cases have civilian counsel who are in the civilian pool. They're noted. Some very accomplished death penalty counsel like Nina Ginsburg from Alexandria, who I understand has done over 100 death penalty cases. Very prominent defense attorneys that make up these teams. And as we go forward, we are going to continue to try to be a voice heard for each and every one of our clients as the review in each and every one of these cases takes place to determine where they're going to go. Where are they going to go? Well, there's really four options. They could be tried in traditional courts martial and in federal district court. Both tribunals have long proven they can handle classified information, battlefield evidence, especially in the court-martial arena, and these international issues of law of armed conflict and death penalty issues, enhanced interrogation, torture litigation, etc. We've consistently on the defense said that that's where these cases should be, and not in an essentially political commissions process, which we believe is fundamentally flawed for a whole host of reasons, one of which is the oxymoron of ever allowing coerced confessions and not properly taking into the consideration of torture and essentially denying the right to confront witnesses. And there's a litany of other things, no age, speedy trial issues, presumptive hearsay admissible. I can go right down the line, and I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to end with again the challenges that the defense and the prosecution has had. In many ways, the prosecution has had a more difficult time than the defense. Seven prosecutors have resigned, including the former chief prosecutor, for not only disputes with General Hartman and the convening authority, but really fundamentally an ethical issue. And that's they couldn't stand up in court and say, Your Honor, I've turned over all the exculpatory evidence to the defense in the government's possession. Because they didn't know. And until we can resolve our interagency lack of cooperation between CIA and between other agencies, et cetera, and get to what evidence is really in these cases, we can't go forward in any of those tribunals. And Colonel Morris's office and the prosecutors before him have struggled with what evidence is really available on those cases. So we welcome this four-month interlay between what's going to go forward in the judicial system and what that judicial system is going to look like. We welcome that. However, at least in the 22 charged cases, we want the voice for these detainees down in Guantanamo Bay to come from their defense counsel, and that voice be heard in whatever judicial process goes forward. Thank you for listening to my comments, and I believe we're going to entertain questions at this point.
And for those who have questions, if you could please come to the microphone so everyone can hear.
Hi, my question is for Colonel Morris. I basically wanted to dispute the premise that those who are most active in advocating against military commissions actually do support some type of national security courts. Actually, many of us would support prosecution instead in our traditional Article III courts. And my question to you is for those of you who do support some type of alternative system, you said how we would deviate from Article III, how you justify departing from any standards required by our Constitution. I understand that there are some evidentiary rules, like maybe tweaking SEPA a little bit, that wouldn't be constitutionally based, but that could be done within our traditional federal court system. But how would you justify in any way departing from our constitutional safeguards that apply in our traditional federal court system if you come up with any alternate system, whatever it looks like?
I don't think you need a new national security court because I think you have one and it's been proved functional. And the system now is not only functional but constitutional. It's constitutional because it predates and versions of commissions existed, contemporaneous with the preceding, actually, and then contemporaneous with the ratification of the Constitution, and then have been used, as you know, in numerous iterations along the way. In general, the commissions that have been used have tracked the evolution of the law. The Winfield Scott commissions, which I think are the great ones to study as well, because they reflected the imagination of a commander and his tremendous fidelity to the rule of law as he was operating kind of our first extended out of the United States operations there in Mexico. So therefore it's not extra constitutional. It is constitutional, and the commissions we have today, of course, are constitutional and doubly statutory based in that they derive from Congress when it passed the UCMJ explicitly providing for commissions. Which is part of the dispute, the issue in the Hamdan decision was whether to what extent Congress expressed authorization of commissions in the UCMJ in 5051 was sufficient statutory authority for the President then to act in 2001. Regardless, you end up with the corrective action of Congress expressly then, as you know, providing for commissions in 2006. To get to your question then of where you deviate, to use your term, from Article III, what you're looking at is not a different body of law or a lesser body of law. My point would be that commissions, national security courts, whatever you want to call them, are an appropriate mechanism even if you didn't need to make any evidentiary adjustment at all. It is a long-standing and proper forum for trying war criminals. So if you had all evidence that you could try in Article III, it is still an appropriate and tested forum. Part of that is you're making the point that these are war crimes. The most recent analysis, the most recent time before 2001 where commissions were heavily considered was the Lockerbie bombings. Those bombings occurred, as you all know, December 88, right on the seam between the Reagan and first Bush administration. And Department of Justice did some real serious study at that time.
obviously, you could come up with a crime for the Lockerbie bombings, right? Blow up 200-some Americans in a plane coming from overseas. So there's got to be some way to charge somebody with murdering a lot of Americans outside the United States. So it wasn't a matter of the unavailability of a conventional legal structure. It was that these turned out to be, you know, imaginative, forward-seeking individuals in the Department of Justice thought, though it is a conventional crime or something else to it, it's more than just a crime, and it sounds more in an act of war, because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't killing Americans incident to something else. It was an intentional slaughter of a couple hundred Americans to make a point against the United States. And therefore, they went and resurrected and studied commissions saying, you know, should there be some way to bring this in some other forum to emphasize that it's an act of war, and ultimately chose not to do so. What we have to decide as a country, what this administration will decide soon, is what costs or compromises you want to take on by using an Article III court. If you use Article III, you see the president's order that sets up, which is his, of course, needless to say, his right and clear prerogative, and relatively clearly stated in his order, a preference for Article III. Therefore, then you look at a case and decide where might we have some difficulty fully presenting a case in an Article III court. Because I would think you would all agree that if you're going to try a case, you might as well fully give your counsel the opportunity to have as much evidence as they can to present. So as I'm walking into an Article III court then, do I want to say, now, but take out of your briefcase any statements that somebody made? You know, put aside the torture thing. I mean, torture is not an issue and has never been with us, in that no prosecutor is going to come close to presenting evidence that would come close to what torture is, separate from how you analyze it, whether any particular technique is torture or not. We who make the decisions about trying these cases aren't going to bother with some close call there, because we have to turn to, you know, the most stringent juries in the world, senior military juries, toughest people to get convictions from, and convince them that it's persuasive evidence. So that's the analysis from a prosecution standpoint. But you have statements taken in a non-coercive but non-Mirandized manner. Can't get them into an Article III court. So the fact that somebody may have talked for hours or days in a way that anybody would acknowledge to be non-coercive, but to say, you leave that briefcase at the threshold of the courtroom because he wasn't Mirandized. Then secondly, we have stuff, passports, hard drives, any number of kind of evidence that was seized overseas in conjunction with organizations or countries other than us in circumstances that can't come close to search warrants. So would not be admissible under the Fourth Amendment. Leave that briefcase at the door, but then come in with the rest of your evidence. Your likelihood of prevailing in that circumstance would be pretty low, which then raises the question of, could it still be consistent with our Constitution to present evidence that is for which the government otherwise can meet the burden of showing it's trustworthy and reliable, though not Mirandized and though not taken in a probable cause setting? I think that's the way it's teed up. It's not an either-or situation. It's notwithstanding its reliability, it would not meet what you would understand to be the conventional tests in Article III. And where are we going to decide as a country? We're going to draw that line while balancing the desire to bring probably some pretty dangerous people to justice.
Let me add to that. You mentioned Winfield Scott. What gave his commission credibility was that he, first of all, invited Congress, warned Congress to legislate to have statutory support. And secondly, when he did put together his commission, he borrowed as much as he could from the Articles of War, from Congress, or from state law. And if you remember after 9/11, one of the advantages the administration said about military commissions, that they'd be speedy and swift and rapid, and we wouldn't have all the delays you'd have in civil court. So you have to ask, after 9/11, whether it'd be smarter for the administration to come to Congress. Congress would have supported it. You could have borrowed as much as you could from the rules of courts martial. Unless they were not practicable, which is what the test is, which finally had to be decided in Hamdan. So we ended up with many, many years of a lot of anger toward the United States, probably
manufacturing a lot more terrorists against us because we didn't come up with a plan that was credible either here or abroad.
Can I just follow up and kind of put the issue from a different perspective? I've had a chance to meet with 9/11 victim family members, and the government, the last two 9/11 cases sessions down in Guantanamo, has actually flown five separate families down, and these are families that have suffered, you know, great loss and are still suffering in a lot of ways when they're brought in and actually sit out behind the glass windows and watch the accused come in. It's incredibly emotional for them, and I'm talking about fathers and mothers of firemen who rushed in, and fathers and mothers and sisters and brothers of people who died in both towers and police officers as well. And there's a real divergent of views among them, particularly the families that the government has brought down, which have had a chance to see the proceedings and actually see Khalid Sheikh Mohammed challenging the military judge for cause and objecting to the chief prosecutor recently, and Bob Swan in the case, and actually being sustained. And they see that, and they say, you know, thank God we're down here, and thank God these things are going forward. You know, we want justice. It's been too long. And this is enough justice for them. That's all they deserve. We need to get on with this, and we need to have justice for our dead family members. And they it's very understandable the views that they hold. And it's also understandable that some of the other family members hold, which is, we want to see justice done as well, but we want to see it done in a real court. And when you do justice in a court that doesn't meet common Article III Geneva standards and our own constitutional standards, you do a disservice to our dead family members. And I submit to you that that's also the debate, and that's the debate from victim family members and I think a lot of the public that's out there. So I think we tend to sometimes to get wrapped up too much in the legal niceties and need to get back to a certain extent to what kind of justice is the United States going to endeavor to proceed with in whatever forum they go forward with, and how can we regain our moral authority, not only to our own victim family members, but to how the world perceives us in our judicial system. And I submit that, you know, in the military justice system, to a certain extent internationally, these commissions process are equated to the military justice system, and they are far, far different. Thank you.
All right. We have time for one short question. I think Major Fracht had that question, and if all the panelists could keep their comments to about 60 seconds on this one. Appreciate it.
Well, my question is actually more of a comment, because I wanted to take issue with a couple of statements made by the chief prosecutor. First of all, most of the crimes that the detainees have been charged with in the military commissions are not war crimes. So the idea that we need to use military commissions because they're war crimes is a false premise. The idea that federal courts are inadequate to the task is also a false premise. I actually defended one of the two trials they've actually held. I didn't actually do anything. I boycotted, but I was there and observed that every piece of evidence that was utilized in that trial could have been admitted in a federal court under the federal rules of evidence. And we have the prosecutors here who tried that case, and I'm sure they would tell you the same thing. There was absolutely no reason whatsoever to be in a military commission in the case of U.S. v. Al-Balul. Finally, the comment that no tortured evidence would ever be offered or even contemplated by the prosecution is simply false. Evidence, statements obtained through torture have been offered. They've been offered in the case against my client. The judge ruled that they were obtained by torture and suppressed them, and the government appealed that and said, oh, they weren't tortured, they were just obtained by coercion, and coerced evidence is admissible in military commissions, and therefore please let it in. So I just don't want people in this room to be misled about what's really been going on at Guantanamo. Thank you.
Comments from the panel? We can start with Colonel Morris.
Well, do please talk to our counsel. In fact, you guys want to stand our excellent counsel in the Ballou case and talk, and do talk to them in the course of the day, because that is a great illustration of the process. Most of the charges, it is an accurate point, most but not all of the charges are war crimes, because when Congress passed the Military Commissions Act of 2006, consistent with Congress authority on the Constitution to define crimes, it added charges other than conventional war crimes. You can be charged in a military commission with war crimes or violations of enumerated statutes that Congress has established. So that's accurate.
And let me just kind of clarify. I said, and this is just a personal view, but, you know, kind of a view from an insider who has met with the President-elect transition team before. But really, in my view, and this is Pete Masciola's view, nobody else's, there's really four alternatives. And what we may end up with are proceedings in four distinct courts, or one being the current commissions, if you will, revised for those cases that do have, quote, you know, evidentiary problems, and another possible civilian national security court, and then traditional courts martial and traditional trials in federal district court. And it may be after a detainee by detainee analysis that cases go forward in a combination of all of those. I think, you know, that's part of the questions that the new administration is going to have to deal with, and how it's going to shake out, we're all waiting to see. However, you know, currently the cases before the military commissions have been continued. They have not been withdrawn. So until some resolution about how commissions, if they are restructured, are going to be structured, and these cases right now are scheduled to go back on the 20th of May in the commission's process.
Let me just say, in recent years, I think there's been a lot of wordsmithing. The administration says we don't torture, but we don't want the CIA restricted to the Army Field Manual because they can have enhanced interrogation, et cetera. So I think after a while everyone recognizes that what has gone on has been abusive methods, and whatever you call it doesn't really matter anymore.
All right. Well, we thank all the panelists and those of you all who had additional questions. Hopefully you'll be able to stop the individuals who have worked on these cases or have other specialized knowledge during one of the breaks. We're going to take about a 10-minute break right now. If you all could be back in 10 minutes, and we'll start our next panel.